Now, before Christmas, the Public Accounts Committee investigated the scandal at the Central Remedial Clinic, which saw money from donations from the public being used to top up executive pay. And you'll probably remember that the CEO of the CRC, Brian Conlon, resigned, and then he refused to appear before the committee. But after he was warned that the Public Accounts Committee would seek to compel him to appear, he did agree to attend, and he should be before the committee early this month. Shane Ross, you're a member of that committee. When will we see Brian Conlon? When will you guys see Brian Conlon?
We'll see Brian Conlon on Thursday week. He's coming on Thursday week to answer a large number of questions, and I think it'll take a lot of time. We had the CRC there for about 6 hours, and a lot of unanswered questions. In particular, I think he'll have to answer questions about his own appointment there. Because you've got a situation where he was on the board of the CRC for many years, and he suddenly is launched in and parachuted in and is appointed to the board himself. We don't know in what circumstances that arose, how it arose, and whether the other candidates who were interviewed already were unsatisfactory, whether someone told him to do this or whether they didn't. That's a very worrying part of what we got. We've got to consider. We've got to also ask him about the circumstances of the pay that he got. The pay that he got is in dispute, but it appears now that he was promised a top up, on top of the fact that top ups had already been promised to be abolished by the CRC. We've got to ask him about the conduct of the CRC during his tenure on the board when he was there, about all sorts of things that were happening there, which were absolutely unprobed at this stage.
And people will remember this payment of $666,000 to the matter for the administration of the pension fund.
I think that one's resolved. That's about the only one that's resolved, actually. But most of them, most of the others aren't resolved at all. And we've got to find out what his relationship with others were. We've got to find out why he resigned, why he actually got out and was refusing to come before the Public Accounts Committee. It's a very murky and very difficult area. I don't want to say too much here because I'm not speaking out of privilege. But I think we've got to find out other things that happened during his tenure there, including a company called Central Remedial Clinic Medical Devices, which was sold by him in November, and the circumstances in which that was sold, because that was all done again behind closed doors.
What services did that company provide?
Well, it appears to have. That's a very good question. What we do know about it was that it was lent $550,000 by the Central Remedial Clinic itself to set itself up, that it lost money every year in an industry which was doing extremely well, that it was completely and utterly unregulated, and that then it was sold without, again, rather like Limerick, going out to tender. And why on earth did that get sold to a rival without going out to tender? There was no advertisement, so we don't know. Even the price at which was paid for it. And there are a large number of other questions like that which have to be answered by Mr. Conlon. I mean, it is a very, very difficult area, because when I initially discovered this extraordinary situation where there was a lot of money going from what was called the Central Remedial Clinic friends and supporters to the Central Remedial Clinic itself, it didn't appear to me that there was so much behind this. And what's actually happened is it escalated into an enormous kind of charity expose, which is happening elsewhere as well, that there is money going elsewhere from charitable funds to top up people's salaries, which is completely unacceptable.
But the Public Accounts Committee can't look at all scenarios because the Charities Act isn't in force yet, so there's no regulation there.
Yeah, this is the problem.
But many of these charities are in receipt of public funds. Mm. That's where the public has, the PAC has a justifiable interest in it. Yeah. That these are public funds. The CRC itself was in.
Do you know what I thought was extraordinary? Looking at this story, was that the HSE, Tony O'Brien, came along and said that there will be a new compliance statement which will need to be signed by voluntary bodies to confirm that they adhere to certain rules. I mean, if you're giving somebody money, you would expect, surely to goodness, to give them a compliance statement and expect them to adhere to certain rules. That this is only coming along now off the back of this scandal is extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, 60 million
they get. The whole area of service provision in the health and disabilities area is, for historical reasons, such a patchwork in this country, where essentially what has happened is that many of these services were provided by charitable and often religious organisations. Now, as the religious have retreated, the successor organisations have ended up providing these these services. And while they are ostensibly, you know, controlled by private or semi-private bodies, they are largely, many of them, funded by the Exchequer. But with almost no oversight, no control, and that's not a problem that anybody there at the moment is responsible for in terms of its structure. But certainly with such vast amounts of Exchequer money, of public money, being paid to people and organisations mm-hmm. over which there is very little, if any, oversight, it seems to me that that whole-scale reform of the sector is required.
Minister Costello, yeah.
Yes, we look forward to listening to Shane grilling Brian Conlon in relation to the CRC.
Well, it's only right and proper that the Public Accounts Committee do that.
Absolutely right and proper that the Public Accounts Committee do it, and they should be doing it all the time. And in fact, I'm surprised this hasn't come to light a lot earlier, because virtually every charitable body does an audit of its own audit and gives an end-of-year report.
Not under regulation, though, because they don't give
very scant information in their annual reports, we had a piece in our paper before Christmas from Jonathan Irwin, who set up the Jack and Jill Foundation, who was calling on charities and was astonished that charities have not, as a result of this, as a result of the CRC scandal, that charities have not come out and said very clear things like how much they pay their CEOs, which many charities are still refusing to do.
That is the problem, of course. But quite a lot of the charitable organisations do so. And I think it's strange that the top-up process has not come to light earlier on. Mm-hmm.
OK, I'm going to leave that one there. And I'm going to come back to you after this, because you're going to tell us what's wrong with the world after this quick break. Welcome back to Saturday with Clare Byrne. Our panel today, Minister of State with Responsibility for Trade and Development, Joe Costello, Independent TD, Shane Ross, Pat Leahy, Deputy Editor and Political Editor of the Sunday Business Post, Niamh Lyons, Political Correspondent with the Irish Daily Mail, and we've been joined by Sean Donnelly, Political Analyst. And we're going to move on now to the prospect, I suppose, of the European elections happening later this year. And we all know that every week brings a new poll telling us just how popular the political parties are with the electorate. But as every seasoned political watcher knows, the only poll that matters is on election day. And so in May of this year, when we come to the local and European elections, the cold, hard truth of how the political land lies will be laid bare. So first of all, before we get down to the nuts and bolts of the European elections, we want to talk about the state of the parties for a moment. Niamh, we'll start with you on this, and perhaps Fine Gael. We'll take a look at Fine Gael first. A bit of a bounce in the polls after the bailout exit. What's your assessment?
Yeah, they've managed to take a lot of the credit for that, and would do as the main coalition partners. I think at the moment, actually Stephen Collins has a good piece in this in the Irish Times today. When you look at any of the parties standing at the moment, for the Europeans, it doesn't really matter as much how the parties stand in the polls. It's a bit of a kind of a personality contest. But that the locals in 2009 were an excellent way of predicting what was going to happen in 2011. So you looked at the boost that Fine Gael got countrywide, and Labour. They both added an extra 4% to their vote, and they managed to do the same thing then again in 2011. Equally, there was a boon for independence. Sinn Féin made some really good gains. And likewise, Fianna Fáil were decimated, as were the Greens. And that's exactly what happened in 2011.
So if you're looking for a midterm kicking, if you're looking for an indication of where that midterm kicking is going to come, it's not the Europeans, you're saying the European elections, it'll be the local
elections. It's the locals. And I suppose any party leader's performance is really going to be judged very carefully. Eamon Gilmore led his party in 2009 into their best ever locals. They had 132 seats on Dublin alone. It was double the seats of Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil.
Yes, 19 out of 30, out of 52.
And it has meant that the mayorship has been dominated by Labour politicians as well. Equally with Enda Kenny at the time, he rebuilt his party, and he did it in the same way as Micheál Martin is doing it now. Went back to grassroots level, had a look at, you know, kind of trying to blood people people for bigger positions farther down the line. I think Fianna Fáil in particular are going to really need to have a good locals and a good European elections, particularly in Dublin. And in Dublin, we'll actually have more seats in the locals than we did the last time. That will help Labour in a big way because they're down in the polls, but they're expected to do well in Dublin. But Fianna Fáil will have to do well in every one of the four councils in Dublin, and they'll really have to secure an MEP if they want to make any progress there. They don't have a TD in Dublin at the moment.
A tall order, Sean, would you say, for Fianna Fáil to try and secure one of those Dublin seats in Europe?
It probably is, yeah. It's only a three-seater. But I think with their poll rating, I'm inclined not to look at a single poll. I'm inclined to look at maybe the year 2013, and there was 33 polls, actually. There's nearly an average of poll every 10 days, so it gives us a fair flavour. And if you look at the different parties, Fianna Fáil you're talking about there, they had a low of 21% and a high of 29%, giving them an average of about 24% for the year. It's not great, but at least it's better than the last general election. I think we have to go back to the 2007 election, because the whole thing changed then. Up to that, elections were predictable. It was a 40-30-10. Fianna Fáil got 40% of the vote, won the election. Fine Gael got 30%, and Labour got 10%. And that's the way it was. And even if you look at the Europeans, that sort of configuration extends. But then this explosion happened, and Fianna Fáil ended up at 17%. Never happened in any party in our history. And that is the unknown unknown. We don't know what's the fallout from that. And if you look at Fine Gael since then, they've had a high of 30% at the end of the year. This year they had a low of 23%, but their average is 27%, and which is what they had back prior to 2011. So they've gone back to where they were. They would argue their vote is more like 30%, because that's what it is in the December polls. Accepting that argument, they're back to the 30% I'm talking about. So really what's happened is they've gone back. Somewhere for the Labour Party, there's a lot of focus on the Labour Party. I think that poll that had them at 6% sort of focus, those sort of figures are inclined to catch the imagination. But if you look at Labour, their average for the year is around 10%. That's where Labour are at. And what happened with Labour is they've had two great successes, 1992 and 2011, where they got 19% of the vote. And that sort of becomes the benchmark for them. But it's not. They're not the exceptions. They're very much the exceptions.
Joe, would you accept that you're at 10%? That's kind of where you're at now, as opposed to 19.
I very seldom disagree with Sean's analysis. He's a veteran in this business, and he's very accurate in general. No, I think he's quite right, and I think he can put it in relation to Labour's position over many years. The two high points, 1992 and in the last election, 2011, each was 19-20%. But in between each of the elections that took place, in 1997 we got 10%, in 2002 the Labour Party got 10%, and in 2007 the Labour Party got 10%. So the Labour Party's position has been steadily, and that was in opposition that period, and then spikes occasionally from time to time.
So is that the ambition then? Is 10% is the bottom line, is it?
No, the ambition is the spike. And we want to build on that.
Well, you need to get Eamon Gilmore home. Isn't that key? Everybody's saying that. You know, yeah, give him the job.
To look at the
actual figures. The Labour Party has the largest number of councillors in each of the local authorities, the four local authorities in Dublin. We did extraordinarily well in the last local election. And part of the reason for that is that Labour, dare I say it, but I believe that the Labour Party councillors are the hardest working councillors in the country.
Sinn Féin now disagree vehemently with that.
If you get a reputation for being up early, then you can stay in bed. But no, the Labour Party continues to be the hardest working councillors everywhere in Dublin. And whenever you have whatever the last poll was 12%, I think, with the Sunday Business Post poll, which was an increase from, I think it was 9%. You know, that would not reflect the actual situation in Dublin. Dublin would always be 3, 4, 5 percentages more than that, at least.
Would you agree that Labour's over the hump now, that when we were at the 6% in the poll stage, that, you know, you were getting a right kicking at that point in time?
I do indeed, Claire. I think it's very true that the Labour Party got the brunt of the blame for the decisions that were made. But it was quite clear also that we put together a joint manifesto. We had put together our own policy initially, and we were looking to get obviously to We would love to be a government that we would be able to run ourselves. That didn't happen. We got less than 20% of the vote. Other parties got 80%, so obviously we weren't going to be able to get all our policies in place. But the joint manifesto we put together with Fine Gael was a roadmap as to how we were going to get out of the unholy mess we were in when we came into government in 2011. We had reached the halfway point by that poll at the end of November. And we had shown that we were about to exit the Troika, the bailout situation, and that we had made very considerable progress. And I think the people were beginning to see that that roadmap was working. And therefore, I would expect that there would be some continuation of a better feel factor as time goes by.
Hope or expect. I want to move on to the European elections now, Pat, and talk to you about these giant constituencies that we have. Dublin remains the same, but we have one stretching from the north right down to the Midlands and then one from the Midlands right down to the south. I mean, the logistics of finding a candidate that can cover that ground are enormous for the parties.
Yeah, I would hate to be a candidate. Well, I mean, I would hate to be a candidate full stop, but I would hate to be a candidate particularly in either the Ireland South constituency or the Midlands North and West constituency. And one of the things that party managers are finding difficult to do is to plan the logistics of these campaigns, because they don't have the template of the previous elections to go on. And you know, it will be a candidate that might be very strong in Wexford, for instance, you know, nobody might have heard of him in Clare. They're still part of the same constituency. So,
but that plays into what Niamh was saying earlier, that you know, you need well-known people.
They will look for high-profile people. They will look for if the sitting MEPs to the largest degree possible that were elected the last time would be strong candidates. Certainly, it would be a media-driven campaign. I suspect, you know, the buzzword is more presidential in style. Most of it will go over people's heads, to be honest. We who are engaged in and monitoring politics will spend half the year worrying about the size of the quota in these constituencies. But for the vast majority of people, they may tune in the few days before the week or two before mm-hmm. the campaign. But the European elections, local elections, tend to be kind of second order elections, which is one of the reasons why you can sometimes see big swings in them and unanticipated results, because people, to put it bluntly, simply don't care about them as much as they care about general elections when they elect a government who will govern them for the succeeding 4 or 5 years. But they don't care about these elections as much. We will probably pay too much attention to them in terms of their significance.
That's because it's so interesting. I mean, we already have a row, don't we, in Labour between Phil Prendergast and John Gilroy.
Who's good one brewing there, all right. I suppose you have a situation where, well, the Labour Party came in, obviously, with three people who none of which are there anymore. Am I right in saying that? There'd be Princess de Rossa, who was replaced by Emer Costello. There was Alan Kelly, who was replaced by Phil Prendergast, and there was Nessa Childers, who's still there, but outside. Actually, what's interesting as well about the constituency, I don't know whether Sean would agree with me on this, but there's the country is technically redivided up, and Clare is back in Munster, and the Ireland South constituency has a little bit of the East in it now, and the Southern Leinster part of it. But there's still kind of two seats in the South, and then, you know, one further over and one up in the Leinster bit. There's in the West, you have kind of the people in Donegal area might be isolated. And if you look, then there's two seats in the kind of Connacht Ulster region, and then there's one sort of in the middle around what were the Leinster constituency, and then there's three seats back in Dublin.
So you're saying you won't have somebody canvassing the length and breadth of that big, huge constituency?
You'll manage to keep a certain amount of it still divided up, but I suppose the issue of how people decide to buddy up, how the transfers go in that situation, and we were speaking earlier this week, Labour and Fine Gael will likely have some kind of pact in that regard.
Sean?
Yeah, I think you still can't get away with the party politics of it. I mean, there's been 100 seats, candidates, MEPs elected since the first elections in 1979. And believe it or not, the breakdown of it was Fianna Fáil won 39, Fine Gael won 31 and Labour won 11. The 40-30 spread that I'm talking about. So the more things change, the more they remain the same in this country. So you just cannot ignore the party thing. That's, you know, and despite the size of the constituencies and all of that, it'll still come down to that sort of a pattern. Dublin will be interesting because it's only got three seats, so it's going to make it very, very tight. Fine Gael, I would think, or should have a seat. I think Fine Gael should have a seat in each of the constituencies, but that's not what they're looking for. They'll be looking for, something like that. And it's going to be difficult, I think, now in the present circumstances for any party to get more than one. We're in a new era here, and this is what I'm going back to again, what happened Fianna Fáil. There's no dominant party anymore. That's why looking forward to the next general election is going to be extremely difficult. We have these big blocks now. We have Fine Gael, we have Fianna Fáil, we have Sinn Féin and the Independents. All, you know, around somewhere around 20% net. And the problem with Labour, what we were talking about earlier on, Labour is slipping away out of that. Mm. They're slipping out of the group. They were the second biggest party back the last time. All the others have come up. They haven't. They've got regret. Sean, and that's where their problem is.
Can I ask you about Dublin and Sinn Féin's chance of a seat in Dublin in that three-seater? How do you rate it?
I think Fine Gael definitely. Then for the other two seats, you're going to have Fianna Fáil, you're going to have Labour.
There
you're
is
going
a left-leaning seat there, but it could go socialist.
There's at least one left-leaning.
Yeah, of course. We don't know what independence.
We know some of them. Eamon Ryan is going to run. We know that there Paul Murphy, the existing Socialist Party MEP, who took over from Joe Higgins when Joe Higgins retired as an MEP. But there will also be a People Before Profit candidate Breed Smith, and I wouldn't be surprised if there are other independent candidates. Peter Matthews is talking about running, may run as an independent. So I think Sean's analysis is probably right that there should be an automatic seat there for Fine Gael, and then two out of a bunch of the others, including Fianna Fáil, Labour, and all those independents.
Actually, what would be very interesting though,
in relation to it all. In 2009, Labour got three seats on 13.5% of the vote. I'm not saying we are in the polls at 12% in the last poll, and if there is a slight curve upwards, we're very close to that again, if things begin to, job creation and
candidates were much higher profile, though, in 2009,
Alan Kelly,
and I understand
Alan Kelly was hardly, hadn't stowed Nessa Childers, wasn't a councillor. Alan Kelly was a senator. Prince Eustace Ross was the only one that was standing MEP. So there is that situation. And of course, Dublin is, as Dublin was during then, it was three-seater at that time, it's still a three-seater at the present time. It's just that the other two constituencies are now four-seaters because we've come down from four threes.
But what Shane is saying is that Sinn Féin and Fianna Fáil have built themselves back up. So the challenge there is it's a more level playing field now, I suppose, if I'm paraphrasing. Labour have been left behind in this thing. That's the problem.
What Sean is saying
is that Labour have been left behind in the context of where we were in 2009. But if the curve continues in the way it is at the present time, by the time the election comes, another 5 months' time, therefore there can be a change and there is only a percentage or 2 points that begin. So there is the possibility, and a strong possibility, of Labour winning seats in all of the constituencies. Don't forget that now there is a four constituency in Dublin, in Ireland South.
Yeah.
When it was a three and we won a seat in a three on 13.5% of the votes. Okay. And that also in the West and the Northwest. And there's some wonderful candidates there. I mean, Phil Prendergast.
Oh, here we go. Yeah.
We have time now for Prendergast.
There is a chance,
I don't see why I shouldn't mention some of them.
Well, you've mentioned.
There is a chance that Labour wins three seats. I think there's a much bigger chance at this point, looking down the road, that it loses all three seats. And one of the things about these elections that I think will have political significance is not so much what actually happens itself, but the political effects that the election results engender, and that's particularly huge in Labour.
Final point, Claire. I think there's a very interesting thing to look at if Brian Hayes actually does contest that seat in Dublin, and there's talk of John O'Mahony in Mayo. We have to have by-elections now within 6 months, post-budget by-election, two very important constituencies there. It could be a really interesting bellwether.
Sure could. Thank you very much indeed. We've got to leave it there. Shane, you're not going to Europe, are you?
I'm certainly not going to Europe. I think it's a
This is a test of the opposition. It's not a test of the government at all.
Thank you very much for joining us today. That's Sean Donnelly, Shane Ross, Joe Costello, Niamh Lyons and Pat Leahy. Thank you for joining us, and we're back here next week at 1 o'clock.
Saturday with Claire Byrne was produced by Peter Woods. The researcher was Leslie Anderson. Broadcast coordinator was Michael Lawless, and sound supervision was by Pather Carney.